Hey everyone, thanks for listening to my podcasts here on the Hullerstubber feed. Do spread the word to other people if you think they might enjoy them. Do listen to some more if you think you might enjoy them, but do enjoy this one. I am shortly going to be on tour with my new stand-up show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Head to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all those dates. Some of them are sold out, some of them have hardly sold anything. It would really help me if you bought tickets to the ones that aren't sold out. Either way, as soon as you can. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. It's about cancer and testicles. One of them's not funny, but one of them's really funny, and it kind of cancels out the unfunniness. I'd say just on average, slightly more funny. So I hope you'll come along. If not, keep enjoying the podcast. We'll be back in September at the Leicester Square Theatre with more live podcasts. Maybe a few Edinburgh ones before then. Sit back, relax, and enjoy this stupid podcast you've chosen to listen to.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. Please welcome a man who once presented Top of the Pops and is now doing this. It's Richard Herring! Oh man, hello, my finest friends. Hello, hooray, it's the last show in the Leicester Square Theatre, though probably not of the series, because we'll do some more. It never ends. When does the new series begin when there's no weeks off? Welcome to Rich Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast. I was talking to Adrian Childs the other day. I was around his house just weeing. We were weeing up a storm. He calls it Rahalastapus. I don't know if that's going to... I'm the most impressed, like a lot of people, this is very topical to the week of recording, but Adrian is a very great... He was a great guest on this podcast. And if you heard his show, he was fantastic. And he's a very interesting man. A lot of people have been slagging him off about having a urinal in his house, which is ridiculous, but that's... but it's a Brighton... Because he's a Guardian columnist, and he wrote a column about it, and that's why people are annoyed about it. And also, he's dating the... And he's going to marry the editor of the Guardian. And so people are saying, well, he's just got that column because his wife's... No, he got the column first. And what really impresses me about Adrian Childs is that... Presumably, the editor of the Guardian must have come round to his house the first time she came round, seen a urinal in his bathroom, and thought, I'm still going to go out with him. That is, I'm the editor of the Guardian, and I'm going to marry a bloke with a urinal. That's the strength of Adrian Childs, his personality. Even that new mo. If you went round to someone's house and he had a urinal in his bathroom, you'd just, I'm going home now. She went, no, it's enough. That Adrian Childs. Fantastic stuff. I would like to thank everyone who contributed to the Kickstarter campaign that allowed us to live stream this show. It's been an absolute failure and we're never doing it again. But thank you. Thank you. Thank you for helping us not lose loads of money doing it. So thank you. Yeah, at least covered itself. So thank you very much. I don't think we will do it again, but you never know. Hello to all the people around the world who are watching this. All over the world. 25 people are watching this. They're dashing around. I wish there was another lockdown, don't you? It was good in the lockdown, wasn't it? It was good in the lockdown. Do you remember what it was like in the lockdown? People would watch you do puppet shows. People would watch you play snooker against yourself and they'd be grateful. Now there's proper entertainment. Oh, no, we're too good for you, Rich. too good for you. My guest this week, I can't believe, has not been on this podcast before. It's very exciting to have him here. You know him. What he's best known for is playing Phil in the film Dog Eat Dog. That is why we that's why we're all here tonight. Will you please welcome the amazing Alan Davies, ladies and gentlemen? Phil. Oh. Welcome. Sit down. Sit yourself down.
Hello.
Thank you very much. Lovely to see you, Alan. Thank you for coming along.
Thank you for having me.
No, my absolute pleasure. Do you remember playing Phil in the film Dog Eat Dog?
Yes, I do remember.
Let's talk about that for an hour.
Playing Phil. Yeah, that was good fun. That was straight to video. No, he was a drug dealer.
Right.
And so what I did was I went, oh, like that, made him speak like that. That's really all I can manage to do. And it was co-written by a guy called Mark Tondorai, who became a good friend of mine and is now directing stuff in America. He's done really well. And it had various guest stars, and including Ricky Gervais.
Yeah, there's an amazing cast in there.
Daniel Kitson as a bus driver and stuff like that. But I remember Gary Kemp was in it, and he played a ruthless gang lord. And one day Mark phoned him up, and he answered the phone, and he goes, "It is I, Gary Kemp." And then he said, "I don't normally answer the phone, but I had a good feeling about this call." And it's quite eccentric, you know, but it's Gary Kemp. He's a massive pop star, and there he is. So I had quite a laugh with him. But every time I've spoken to Mark for 20 years since, whenever we phone one another up, we always go, "It is I." I mean...
It sounds like it's the first time he ever answered the phone. You know, he'd never seen anyone do it.
You know, it's Warmington 393. And then over years, it came, "It is I." I mean, I felt like he meant to say something else. And it came out wrong. And, you know, perhaps he was in the middle of something. And he meant to say, "It's me." And then he thought, "Oh, perhaps that's not posh. That's grammatically wrong. You're supposed to say, 'It is I.'" But of course, you're not. You're supposed to say, "Hello. Can I help you? Who's calling, please?" Or, you know, anything will do.
Yeah.
But "It is I" was a fucking disaster. And it's funnier, though, if you really go for it. If you really go, "It is I," it really does. It will make your friends laugh and laugh and laugh and laugh. And laugh and laugh and laugh and laugh.
I think it is.
Every time I see Spandau Ballet, you know, in 80s pop shows... And they're going, "Work till your muscle bound," and doing all that. I got to know Tony Hadley a bit because we used to do stuff for the same charity.
Yeah.
And then he's a lovely, lovely bloke. And he's always doing gold. But I can't. And he used to fell out with Gary Kemp so badly.
Oh,
sued really? Him three times.
Oh, like, no.
Unsuccessful. And people kept saying to him, "Tone, for fuck's sake. He wrote the fucking songs. He's been proven in court twice. And why are you suing him again?" Because I said, it was the way I did gold. Oh, Tone. But he was never pretentious. He would never go, "It is I, Tony Hadley." And I did a charity show with him once, and his son is older now. His son was about 12 at the time. And Tony went backstage and came out in some leather trousers to do his set. And his son goes, "Nice strides, Dad." I really undermined him. And I didn't have children at the time, but I remember seeing that thinking, Jesus, children can really just cut you to the quick, can't they? I mean, this guy was a world superstar. And his 12-year-old floored him. And he kept looking in the mirror at his trousers. "Well, what's wrong with these? What's wrong with these?" Like... I said, "Pay no attention, Tony. You look great. You look great."
My daughter, who's 7, and I didn't think this would happen when she was 7, has started sarcastically calling me Richard all the time. And she does it, like, properly. "Hello, Richard." And she, like, knows it's a ridiculous name and calls me by my first name sarcastically, and it's absolutely crushing.
My kids now, I shout at them too much, and I do use them in my act. I mean, I do exploit them in my act. I don't know if it's really exploiting them, because, of course... I am buying all of their food and clothes and stuff. So, I mean, I sort of regard it as earning their keep. But their mum, my wife, important to clarify that, went away for a few days because her mum was having an operation. So she went off to stay with her mum for a few days. So I'm there with the kids. And I got increasingly irate each morning because every fucking day it's the same. Where are your shoes? Well, why is one here? I don't know where the other one is. I can't find my shoe, they say. And then they just piss off and play with Lego for an hour. And I go, where's your book bag? And why haven't... Eat your breakfast! Why don't you do anything I say? And then I said to them, one time, OK, that's it. Now, I have to go and get ready. I'm going upstairs. And when I come down, what am I going to say? And the five-year-old goes, get fucking ready! And then he absolutely pissed himself laughing. And I laughed. You're not supposed to laugh. Get fucking ready! And that is, I promise you, if you come to see me do a stand-up set, which is infrequent these days, that is the biggest laugh in the show.
Jeez, I swear in front of the kids all the time. Is that...
I can't not. I thought I shouldn't for a while. And then, oh, for fuck's sake, I'm going to say, don't swear, Daddy. Oh, well, just... honestly, I mean, I've called him every word under the C word. Yeah. You know. So disappointed in myself time and time again.
Yeah.
But, you know... I'm shit at it. I can't help it.
It's sort of bad. They become obsessed with the word fuck now, both kids. But I've managed to make them not to say it, but that every now and again they go, are we allowed to say the F-U-C? They think it's like F-U-C, and, you know, so it's like, it's out of a seven-year-old's mouth. It's
my
pretty...
My kid said to me, came over, he goes, can I say, for goodness sake? Yeah. And we said, yeah, you can say that. He goes, can I say, fuck goodness sake? And we go, and you have to say, no, I don't think so. And he goes, oh, I can't say anything.
It's a fun time when you're trying to work out what's rude and what's not rude, and you get it wrong. It's like, you said blooming heck. Can you say blooming heck?
Yeah, fudge and feck and whatever.
Anyway, what do you think about Adrian Charles, urinal in the house? Would you?
I have never in my life wanted my own urinal. I think, having said that, I've encountered a lot of complaining in my life from people about the male aim, you know. And I have had friends round watching the football or something, or just socialising that. And the male aim has been appalling at times in my own toilet, so I do sympathise.
But is that better in a urinal than a toilet's bigger than a urinal? There's
more
chance of getting...
Yeah, but I think you're closer to it.
Getting in there.
Yeah, and I wouldn't have a standard urinal, I'd have a bespoke.
Would you go for the full wall length down to the floor?
Well,
I
imagine a urinal with a kind of a seat coming forwards, so you're facing, but you're still sitting. and you're leaning back.
Yeah.
And then maybe there are moving targets like in an old fashioned arcade. What I'm seeing is an opportunity to turn it into something, you know, with a high score.
Yeah. I think there's not, you know, I think the urinal, whoever's in charge of urinals, they haven't got it right yet. There's always piss everywhere and it's, you know.
Yeah, there is. Well, I had a friend when I was at school called Danny, who was my best friend. He now lives in emigrated, very sadly for me, he emigrated to Australia in 1991. But sadly for him, he's a Manchester United supporter. And the following year, they started winning every single thing. But we used to call him the Squirt because there was in the pub we used to go in, there were high up windows above the urinals, and he was the only person who could wee out of those windows. And I'm talking seven or eight feet up.
That is good.
So, I mean, you know, Adrian's actually, I think, been a bit tame with the bog standard. The bog standard bog.
That does. I remember the days when, you know, it's the trajectory through life as well of the urine is a very sad thing because now it just falls out of my penis, basically.
Well, yeah. I mean, a urinal now is really just holding a pipe pot.
But I used to be able to shoot. There used to be a wall in our urinals at primary school and you had to wee over the wall. And people were passing on the other side. So
I think also there comes a point in life when you're bothered about splashback.
Yeah.
And I think up to a certain age, you just don't bother at all with how much piss is all over you and everybody else. You are disgusting.
Yeah, it's true. Do you have anything in your own house that if someone was to come in and go, have you heard Alan Davies has urinal in his bathroom? Is there anything that you think is unusual?
Some people think it's pretentious that I have a bidet.
Yeah.
They think that's like that. That's exactly the sort of noise that an English person will make at the idea of someone having a clean arsehole. That's what's really... The rest of the world is thinking, how do you clean your arse? With handfuls of tissue? What? That's disgusting. Don't you then get shitty clumps of tissue? Yeah, every day. What do you do with that? You put it down the loo. What the fuck, don't you wash your arse, you disgusting pigs? But here we're like, ooh, get you, clean arsehole. Ooh, weirdo. I use my inside of my pants.
It's quite. My parents had a bidet in the 1980s, I would say.
Did they really?
That's... Yeah, but then they don't have a bidet anymore.
Was it a coloured one, like an orange?
Yeah, it was. It was avocado. I think it was probably avocado. That was sweet. I mainly used it to wank in. I think.
Did you? Really?
Yeah. I mean, I've used everything to wank in, but it was. You could shoot water, you know.
I think it's fair to say there is nowhere. There is no place or situation that you could come up with where someone hasn't had a pen. That's how much of an epidemic we're talking about in male behaviour. Let's move on.
Good.
Right. Or perhaps this podcast is the last remaining.
I don't think anyone... I don't think anyone's done it on stage.
There may be somewhere out there in the dark.
I'm pretty certain someone will have wanked out there in the audience, but not so far, not on stage.
Perhaps not with this guest, but some of the others are better.
Some people find it very sexy. There's definitely people at home masturbating the minute we start talking about wanking.
Take it as a cue.
Yeah. It reminds you, look, you can sometimes forget. Could be having
a couple
a wank
of days, then. Actually.
Well, let's. I don't, you know, there's so much to talk to you about. Did you see this week or a couple of weeks ago? Mark Lamar, I think, tweeted a set, like the list of the acts
yes,
that were in.
I did see that.
Was it the
Meccano Club?
Yeah, in 1991.
There's several weeks of bills with lots of names. Of course, you and I recognise pretty much all of them.
Yeah.
What I liked most about it was handwritten and biro on a piece of paper. And there was quite a few, and I imagine Mark doing this, but that didn't turn up. Noted. But also, there was Tippex used.
Yes.
I love that at the bottom, he's Tippex something out.
It says Izzard Eddie, and then there's arrows pointing the other side. He thought Eddie Izzard was called Izzard Eddie, and then that's the point we're talking about in this.
I did a radio show, and I know that you also did the same show for Radio 1, when they brought in from BBC Light Entertainment blocks of comedy hours.
Yeah.
And so you'd have to play some music. We didn't know what music to play. We're all very out of touch. And Oasis had just started up, you know. And their first single was called Supersonic. And I'm announcing, and all I had on my script was Oasis Supersonic. And I'm going, is this Supersonic by Oasis, or is it Oasis by Supersonic? And I'm looking through the glass, and they're all going, we don't know. And I had to back announce the track. And, as you know, it's a brilliant track. To back announce the track, and I went, Oasis Supersonic. Anyway, and just did it, left it. Styled it out, proud of myself.
Well, talking of Oasis, you've angered Liam Gallagher recently. Can I read you the tweet that he...
Please do.
I don't know. There's a lot that I love about this. Alan Davis, you need to fuck off to another country, and that is asterisk, so I'm presuming he's spelled C-U-N-T-R-Y.
I think he's wrongly spelt the word country.
One where they don't got a sense of humour, you'll fit right in, you unfunny spunk bubble, MCFC, LG, kiss. The kiss is my favourite bit. How did you anger Liam Gallagher so bad? It's a football related...
Well, it was about football, yeah, because I've done a podcast now. For about, I think three listeners we've accumulated a huge following called the Tuesday Club, and we've been doing it for about 13 years, and we occasionally rant about, you know, the opposition
yeah.
and in a very biased and irrational way. And that's good fun for us. But since the advent of social media, things can get taken a little bit out of context and can go somewhat viral and end up in the papers. And I was on a rant about Manchester City and all the money they've had from Abu Dhabi, and now it isn't fair, and they've spent £1 billion and yeah. blah, blah, blah. And they played at our ground. I'm an Arsenal fan, for everyone who doesn't understand. And they played at our ground and won in the last minute, and we felt very hard done by numerous refereeing calls, recorded the next day, and, as is traditional, lost the plot with fury over it. And it turns out that they're really touchy about this subject, the City fans. United yeah. fans aren't bothered. Chelsea fans just take the piss out of you, you know. City fans are really touchy about it because they know they never would have won anything without all that money. So, and then he said that, and then about a few days later, he lives near me.
Right.
He lives near me in Hampstead. I've seen him in Wagamama's.
Is it a special Wagamama's with cloth serviettes and stuff in it? You don't have to sit.
He was sitting with his ex-partner.
Right.
And they didn't look like they were enjoying the miso soup. They were sitting side by side and facing straight out into the restaurant as if to intimidate all the other diners. Quite successfully. He looks absolutely furiously angry. And I was walking my daughter to school. We go across Hampstead Heath to walk her to school. And we played Liverpool the night before and lost. And I saw this guy, and he had a big hoodie on and a hood and sunglasses and what looked like trousers, but also a skirt. I couldn't quite work out the outfit, and he was limbering up on this kind of railing. And he goes, "All right, Arsenal." And I thought maybe it's a Liverpool fan just having a little pop about the night before's match. And as I said, "All right, mate, nice bit of kit." Walked on with my dog and my daughter. And then about 50 yards, I thought, "Oh, shit, that was Liam Gallagher." That was absolutely definitely Liam Gallagher. No one else wears those sunglasses and that sort of a thing. And so, but he didn't chase me down and finish me off in front of my child. It's got some standards.
The tweet was enough. I think once he'd done it, I think this is the kiss at the end. It's like, I've got it out of my system and we're friends. The kiss says we're friends again. As long as you fuck off to another country. I mean, that's... But not country, a country.
But I mean, I imagine that he thought that that was about as hard as abuse as you can dish out on Twitter, and he is sorely mistaken. As many of his compatriots from Manchester have absolutely outdone him in recent weeks. It's a wonderful town. I love it up there. Yeah.
Of course. Well, while we're on that, some other stories I'd like to hear about from your real life. I saw something about you setting off Neil Kinnock's burglar alarm.
Oh, yes, that's true.
Is that true?
It is true. I have to apologise for my croakiness because I'm a bit chesty and I had COVID and... discovered having not had COVID all the time and thought I was immune and then when it got me, it proper took me out. So I'm a little bit weird. But I'm not contagious, front row. I'm not contagious, number one, I'm clear. But yes, I knew Glenys Kinnock because I did a chat show with Ruby Wax. Ruby Wax used to do a chat show where you'd sit and have dinner, basically. And Anna Massey was on, and Glenys, and me, and Ruby. And I really liked Glenys a lot. She was brilliant. She was a very forthright, very smart, very intelligent, great company, likes a beer, good fun, you know. She's not well at the moment and it's very sad. You know, Neil's having to sort of look after her. And towards the end of their days, as it were. But I was very, very fond of her. And we went to a restaurant and Ruby Wax was good friends with Alan Rickman and Alan Rickman sitting next to me. And I had this absolutely amazing night. You know, sometimes when you do this job, most of the time you have a normal day, see your normal people, do your normal work. And sometimes you're with Alan Rickman and Glenys Kinnock and it was amazing. So we got on well and I did a show in the West End in 1998, a couple of weeks of stand-up. And I invited them. They said, "If you're ever doing a show, let us know." And I invited them to come, and they came to the show. And he'd been to see Wales play rugby at Wembley because they didn't have a home stadium at the time because they were building it. And then he came to see my show, and then we went to a restaurant afterwards, and we had a big meal, and there was a good laugh. And he goes, at the end of it, he goes, "I've had a great day." And I'm very fond and full of admiration for both of them. And then, a couple of years later, I was going over to Belgium, because I'm a big football fan, and England were playing Germany, and I got tickets, and I had nowhere to stay. And I rang their office. They were both in Brussels at the time. He was an EU commissioner, and she was an MEP. And I rang their office saying, "I can't get a hotel room. Surely, is there somebody there who can pull a string and recommend a hotel where there's a room?" And the message came back almost immediately, "Stay at our house." And I said, "Really?" And I said, "Yeah, we're not there. Help yourself. There's wine in the fridge in the basement." And we said, "All right, you'll come into such and such an address, and someone will take you around there." And you go around there, and they say, "Right, now this is the security code. Now this is important. This is not an ordinary burglar alarm. If this goes off, shit hits the fan." So I was with my mate, Jez, and we said, "No, he's got to remember this number." We're going, "Okay." And then if it goes off, and the phone will ring, and you have to say, and I think it was Maison de la Bouche, but it can't have been. But... okay, and we went, yeah. Then we get on the train to Charleroi in Belgium, and on the way, it's a packed train, people are ringing up saying, "Are you all right? It's all over the news. Are you there? Are you in the water cannon? Are you in trouble?" And then we felt like we were on a troop train, and there was terrible, badly, badly behaved supporters, you know, who I do not condone, and there was a lot of mess and several water cannon. But we went in the ground, and England won 1-0. David Beckham made a brilliant cross for Shearer, I think it was. And everyone's digging the Dan Busters theme and doing Lancaster Bombers and really making absolute idiots themselves. But at the same time, having one of the best nights of their lives. And then we got back to the house and we set the burglar alarm off. And we were quite pissed and really tired and just kept keying in the wrong number. And this wasn't like this was the loudest sound I've ever heard. I felt nauseous. It felt like it was reverberating in your intestines. Like eventually, if you stayed there long enough, you would pass out from the sound of it. It was like something from The Prisoner. And the phone rang, and Jez went, "Maison de la Bouche!" And whatever he said convinced them, and it stopped. And then we watched the highlights. But oh, what a wonderful night.
Presumably you would have been taken out by the SAS or something.
Armed police would have come, without a shadow of a doubt. And we just looked like two football fans who'd broken in. No, we didn't, neither of us had a word of French or Flemish.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact. You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And, is it true? This might not be true. I think it is. I think I remember this. I think it is true. Did you pay £30,000 to buy the original Big Brother diary room chair?
Yes.
Do you regret that decision in hindsight?
A little bit.
For charity, right? It was for charity.
It was for charity. Yeah. It was for three charities for homeless people, and they did an auction of everything in the house to raise money for homeless charities because it was a house. And, you know, it was the first series, and it was the purple chair. And what was happening was the son were bidding for the chair because they had a deal with Nasty Nick.
Right.
And they wanted the chair. And the producers knew that I was bidding. And they called up and said, we do not want the son to have this. Right? And they've bid 30 grand. Could you bid 30 grand and 1p? And I had made quite a lot of money in the previous couple of years. I'd done adverts for Abbey National. I'd always felt slightly guilty about taking this shilling and selling out. And I did get a little bit of stick from people, you know, old friends of mine like Mark Steele, who made a few eye-rolly, sarcastic remarks, quite rightly. But it was too much to turn down. And I just didn't have the backbone to walk away. And so I gave some of it to this auction to assuage some of my guilt. And I've still got the chair. I've still got it at home. And then recently, before the pandemic, Somerset House did an exhibition of artifacts from television. And,
right.
And it was, they said, can we borrow it? And I just thought they were going to say, can we buy it? You got 500 quid, it's yours.
I think it might have depreciated. I think it might not be worth 30 grand.
Well, the really funny thing about it, it was quite a nice chair. It's one of those egg chairs. And they were quite rare at the time. And to buy one was about 2.5 grand. They were quite fancy. And I actually did like the chair. And then one day, Foxton's had a massive refit. And every branch of Foxton's in London had about 20 of these poxy chairs in there. So overnight, it went from this, you know, iconic bit of furniture into a Foxton's chair. Embarrassing.
Never mind. Let's talk about Look, for the second week in a row, we have Taskmaster.
Yes.
Taskmaster TV detective on. How did you enjoy your time in the Taskmaster house?
Well, I did enjoy it. I mean, I didn't do that well. I mean, sometimes you think you've done well and you haven't, and sometimes the opposite. But it's good fun, and I think it's quite important to try your best with the tasks.
Yeah,
and I did try my best, and I was evident when they played it back in the studio when you sit together, as you know, and Alex and Greg are there, and they start taking the piss out of you. And you realise, when you see yourself, it's never pleasant to see yourself, ever. I mean, whoever you are, you know, when you see yourself in your own holiday snaps, you know, if you catch sight of yourself, is anyone like this? If you catch sight of yourself in a shop window as you walk past, you go, oh, Jesus Christ. And so I was like, oh, no, look at this idiot. But I can honestly say I've never laughed so much in the studio my life as I did on those recordings. You do 5 days, I guess it's a 10-show series, so 2 shows a day for 5 days, and everything that Greg and Alex say is funny. Everything that everybody said was funny. Really nice bunch of people. Victoria Coren Mitchell, I know quite well. Desiree Birch, who I know.
Yeah.
Gus Kahn, who I'd never met. And Morgana Robinson, who I'd never met. But we really got on. Everyone got on. And it was hysterically funny. And people actually came to me in the break saying, are you all right? Because I was really laughing. So I was glad I did it. I was apprehensive about being made a fool of, you know. But they don't want to make a fool of you. Yeah. They know you will do that anyway.
And luckily you're on with Victoria Coren Mitchell, who couldn't ride a bicycle. So, you know, it was... who learned to ride a bicycle on air.
On air. But everybody said, you know, Victoria consulted David Baddiel and I consulted Lou Sanders and Joe Brown, the people who've been on, and they all said, just got to go on, it's so much fun.
Yeah, it really is fun. Our studios were right after the first lockdown, so it was literally the first time any of us had been out of the house for 4 or 5 months in July. And the first day, we just, if you watch it, people say, were you all crying because Greg was too rude? We all just got tears down our face, and I just cried. We laughed
really,
all
really
day.
It's really, really funny. It's hard to explain, but it's so funny.
Yeah, it's amazing. Good. I'm surprised out of all your things, and you maybe are surprised about this as well. There's obviously some big things that succeeded and did many, many series, and we'll get on to those perhaps. But I thought Whites was a very good series, and you only did one series of that. Was that them or you? Was
it rankles, Richard. It does rankle, that. Whites was a sitcom we did for BBC Two in 2010, and it's called Whites, which is a reference to Chef's Whites, because it's set in a restaurant. And I play a guy who kind of wannabe celebrity chef who's now on the way down. Too lazy and conceited to do any work, so puts it all onto his sous chef, who's very put upon, and there's a really lippy chef in the... And then he's flirting with their restaurant manager. Great characters and relationships. And one of the reasons why it worked was because it was written by Matt King and Ollie Lansley. And Matt King used to be a chef. So we had lots of people who worked in restaurants, especially on social media, saying, this is bang on. This is exactly it. And it was terrifically good. I was very proud of it. The ensemble cast, Izzy Sooty played a waitress, hysterically funny. And we all loved making it, and we were ready for season two, and it just didn't happen. There were several shows in the mix, and I felt... I remember at the time there was a show called Episodes, which was written by a couple of American writers and had Matt LeBlanc in, and had a bit of co-production money from the States, and that got recommissioned, and I felt... Which is fine, you know, not knocking that show. It went to several series, it was good. But I did feel slightly that the BBC ought to be backing Ollie and Matt. Yeah. As two writers who'd not worked together before, not had anything on before, young English writers, you know, state broadcaster, come on, back them, support them, give them another series. Yeah. They had a lot of scripts ready, and it got canned. And of all that's actually really, that is the biggest disappointment in my whole career, that we didn't get to do more of those. But I'm very, very proud of the ones there are, and you do still get people, because it crops up now and then, you know, it'll appear on one of the streaming services, and people say to me, any more Whites? People always assume, because I'm the lead actor in things, it's up to me. Yeah. You know, and I did argue, and I tried to argue with the BBC, and my agent at the time was very bad-mannered, and he upset a lot of people. But I did say to them, can we talk about why you've done this? And they said, we'll have a meeting with you, but not to discuss Whites. We just want to reiterate our faith in your talent. What are you on about? That isn't even English. And I said, Matt, and it's not just me, it's Matt and Ollie have written the thing, you know. They said, well, maybe they could write something else for you. I said, you understand, you must understand, it's a four-year process from the first taster, 10-minute taster that they made, that they did themselves, to getting a table read, to getting a pilot, to writing six scripts, to getting the thing on air. It's 4 years of development, and you get it on, and then you can it, and then you say to them, why don't you come up with something else? It's Kafkaesque.
Yeah.
It was very upsetting. And at the time, actually, QI had just had a little period on BBC One. They tried us on BBC One between the soaps, it didn't go well. our audience couldn't find us, and the new audience did not know what the fuck was going on. Stephen Fry was coming out with all this stuff. So they said, we're going to relaunch it on BBC Two. Oh, yeah, whatever. Spin it however you want. This is a balls up, right? We're going back on BBC Two, and I was slightly concerned that maybe Whites didn't make it because QI was coming back to BBC Two. Maybe they thought, we don't want him in two shows. Well, we'll commission it. I don't know. I just couldn't understand the process, because you weren't told what the process was. And then I said to John Lloyd, I don't know if I should do QI anymore, because I really like acting, and if I'm just too ubiquitous and too much on QI all the time, how can anyone cast me in anything? Everyone just says I was that bloke off QI. And so he started looking for someone to replace me. And we've been friends for years. That was the fun. I met John Lloyd making the ads for the Abbey National.
Oh, right.
He directed all the ads. So I was quite conflicted about taking a shilling and making adverts. Actually, John made all those ads, and we became quite good friends. And while we were doing that, he said, I've had an idea for a panel show where you get points for being interesting. You don't have to get the questions right. You just get points if you're interesting. Mm-hmm. What do you think? And I said, it sounds good. Because what I liked about panel shows was all the off-the-cuff stuff, you know, not the scripted jokes that you went in prepared with, but the off-the-cuff. And I said, he said, you're the only person who thinks it's a good idea. Will you do the pilot? So I said, absolutely, I'll do the pilot. And the pilot had Izzard Eddie in it.
Right.
And Bill Bailey, who was my good friend, who I introduced John to. You've got to have Bill on, he's brilliant. Yeah. And Kit Hesketh-Harvey from Kit and the Widow, very funny.
And John wrote the entire script, and that was in 2002. So,
right.
Yeah, we started doing that, and I'm still doing that. And I really am I'm an apologist for being so ubiquitous and on so much. But, you know, now I've got three kids, so that's...
I mean, I mean, I know it's a good thing, and QI is a great show, but to be on one show for 20 years, like, there aren't many people who've done that. I guess, have I got news for you? I guess Paul and Ian have been doing that for maybe
even
30
longer.
Years.
Yeah. 30 years, yeah.
You know, it's kind of, I think for a stand-up, it can sometimes just sort of, I think when Phil Jupitus was on Buzzcocks, you know, it's very easy just to get your feet under the table and think, right, Phil sort of stopped doing stand-up for a bit and then he came back to it when he stopped. I know you've been doing stand-up, but is it sometimes think maybe I should move on and away from this, or is it just...
You do think that.
Yeah.
I mean, you think that frequently, and you don't always enjoy... People say, oh, that looks like a right laugh, that must be a right laugh. And then, yeah, but you see the half an hour...
Yeah.
It's not always a laugh, obviously, some of the stuff I'm not interested in, and I've really had to fake a lot of interest in things, and I have no idea what's going on. I don't understand the question. I've got no idea what the answer is, and I'm spending the entire time in the dark trying to think of something funny. Frankly, Richard, it's exhausting.
Yeah.
And I'm not always successful, and so it's a mixed blessing, but in the end, I sit in the chair and think, if I said I'm leaving, the queue to sit here would go around the block.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very privileged position to be in, and the thing is, we're doing the alphabet, right? We're doing it's John's master plan. Series one was A, and we're so close to 26 series now, I really now feel like I can't... leave. But I mean, at the same time, I've always thought, I mean, I don't know what you feel, the slight sense of imposter syndrome. You're always thinking someone's going to tap you on the shoulder and say, that's enough now, you know, we're going to try Josh Widdicombe next year, or the time has come.
It's a testament that hasn't happened. I don't think that would happen with this, but it is quite unusual. You know, even with Buzzcocks, they were pushing people in and out, and some people were leaving and some people were being pushed out. So it is sort of amazing, you know, and I'm not saying you're crazy for doing it, because quite the opposite, because it's a great show. But, you know, Stephen Fry was on, I think, just after he decided to stop doing it, and he was talking about how frustrated he was getting, obviously, with doing QI.
Well, the problem with it was, we always sound daft because we're lucky to do the job we do and we get well paid and all the rest of it, but the problem was they started making us do three records in a 24-hour period. We used to go meet up, go in the green room, and Stephen would be a welcoming host to everyone, a lot of chat and banter, go in the studio, do some dummy questions, people, if they wanted a gin and tonic or whatever, would have one, and there was a nice jolly atmosphere. There'd be a warm-up guy on stage doing 20 minutes of funny stand-up, the audience, 650 people, Stephen would bring you on one at a time, you'd do the show, then you'd go to the bar. It was really fun.
Yeah.
And the shows were great. And then one day they said, we want to do two in a day. And we thought, do you? Oh, God, that's going to be 4.5, sometimes 5 hours, sitting there having no idea what's happening or what you're going to say. And we're doing one the night before. So if you do three in that time, by the third show, your eyes are starting to close and you keep thinking of hilarious callbacks to things that happened yesterday. And it's a little bit of an endurance test.
Yeah,
it does take the edge of a little bit of the... But the thing is, if you do that once and no one dies... I think we've saved that amount of money.
Yeah.
It's all about the budget, and the budget keeps getting cut and cut and cut and cut and cut. And then though I get well paid, my money's been the same. It's the same in 2022 as it was in 2010.
Right.
You know, it's exactly the same.
Yeah.
And that's, it's been constricted and constricted and pushed and pushed and pushed. And I think in the end, I think Stephen just found it a bit too much.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, I know that he was conflicted about leaving. I miss him very much, you know. I love him to bits, but I totally got it. That
it's an interesting. I think as a stand-up, and I think I remember when I started doing stand-up, you'd got to that point where you were, you'd won the Time Out New Comedian or something, and you were up there, and you're a great stand-up, and you have carried on doing stand-up all that time. It's that trade-off, isn't it, between. You know, doing the work you like. I think acting in a way it takes you away further from stand-up.
Acting takes you away further.
Yeah.
It definitely does. If you do 5 months on a shoot, you are knackered at the end of it, and, you know, and you're not. And I think 90 hours a week might be too much. I don't know. What do you? Stop moaning, yeah. You. Oh, well, stop moaning. But you can't then, to get back into stand-up and come up with new material, you can't stand-up, as you know, you have to be gigging all the time. You have to be constantly. I don't write my material. My material is come. I jot notes down and go on and ad-lib and talk through it until stuff emerges. I can't come up with material without gigging, and I couldn't gig because I was working. And also I had a couple of gigs where I went to the Comedy Store and I was getting a bit of Jonathan Creek this and Caroline Quentin something else and Abbey National, you twat, and, you know, and I was trying to, you know, beat a riff off the cuff, and I left, and all the comedians in the dressing room were thinking, yeah, he's died on his arse, flash cunt. But I didn't go back there for 10 years,
right.
And actually that really upset me because I loved it. That was my first love. That's when people say, what's your job? I say, I'm a stand-up comedian. That's my job. If everything else stops, which I've been expecting to happen for about 20 years, that's what I would do. I'd be on a stage just like this, entertaining an audience as best I could, just like this. You know, that's my job.
Yeah.
And I didn't do it for 10 years, and I got pushed back into it by a friend of mine called Marnie Fowlis, who's a promoter in Australia. And we were going to Australia to do QI Live. So off we go to do that. And she said, why are you here? Why don't just do some gigs? You should do gigs. You're good at stand-up. And you haven't done it for 10 years. What's going on? I said, I don't know. We do QI. That's a live audience. So I kind of... She goes, no. This is ridiculous. You've got to get back into it. She just basically bullied me like she's got three sons, and I've seen the way she talks to them. And I just she talked to me exactly like that. Get off your ass and do something about it, you know. And yeah. I needed that, and and that was in 2011, and that tour was went amazingly well. And when you haven't got an act as a stand-up, you always think you'll never think of another funny thing. You just think there's never. You look at old routines that you enjoy doing. Think, I'll never think of another routine like that, but you do, you know. You do if you apply yourself, if you gig and find little venues and. And that's what I did. So I toured for about 5 years, solid. And now I try and do, like I'm doing one in Canterbury next month, I'm doing one in Bristol in June, just try and have a gig every now and then to keep my hand in.
Well, it's good. You know, I'm glad that you are doing stand-up again because it's, you know, you are and were fantastic at stand-up, so that's fantastic. I want to say as well that I've just been listening to your audiobook, which we don't need to go into great detail with now, and we can if you like, which is Just Ignore Him, which is an absolutely amazing piece of work, Alan. I have to say, it's beautifully written.
Thank you.
I mean, it's about your, you know, very troubled and sad, very sad childhood, really. And it's, you know, it's quite difficult to listen to because there's a lot of. You know, it's very honest, and you've had to go through a lot of stuff. Not only losing your mum, which would be bad enough, but the all the stuff that comes after that as well. Why did you want to write that book? Because it is, you know, it's there's funny bits in the book, but it's pretty serious stuff.
It is, yeah. I couldn't carry it around any longer, really.
Yeah.
The story where I had this my relationship with my father, it was kind of traumatic events. I mean, it's quite publicised by now what went on. And I didn't want to write a vengeful book. I didn't want to get my own back. And I wanted to tell the truth, and I wanted to get it out of me. Because every time I thought about writing anything, this stuff from my childhood would keep coming up and block me up almost. And I'd never been able to address any of it at all in stand-up. Stand-up was always a kind of a little bit skin deep. And because I never really went away as a comedian and tried to write monologues and really think, what do I want to say on this subject? I would just write down things I thought were funny, say them to an audience. If they laughed, I'd say them again. And it never really went further than that. Yeah. You know, it was an entertainment. It was fun. And this, to get to really... deep, to go really... There's a lovely line that Seamus Heaney talks about, dipping a bucket through the skin and pulling, you know, like a bucket for a well, into your, and then pulling it up, and that kind of imagery of what's really there. And I did an MA writing course at Goldsmiths College, and it was the best decision I've made because it gave me an opportunity to try and write about these things with my father and losing my mum and no one was going to read them apart from the people on that course. You know, it was a safe space of which everyone was very respectful and very eternally grateful for.
Yeah.
And I worked really hard and really got a lot out of that. And then at the end, it was a decision whether to publish or not. And by this time, the police were interviewing my father and was trying to make some headway with it, which, as you'd find if you read the book, mixed outcome.
Yeah.
But I got it out, and I did. I wrote the best sentences and the best paragraphs I could manage. I tried to make something worthwhile out of it. We had a brilliant short story writer, well, also a novelist, called Claire Keegan, who came to our college and talked to us one day. And she said to us, you need to go towards the loss. And everyone in the room immediately knew what she meant, because the loss is different for each person, you know. Mm-hmm. And she said, I know writers, and they say, oh, I love writing. It pours out of me. I write thousands of words. And she said, I think they may be a lost cause. You know, if it's easy, you're not doing it properly. It's like anything.
Yeah.
And she said, you've got to go towards the loss. My tutor said to me, write the things that make you cry. Write things as if no one's going to read it. You know, no one's over your shoulder. You have to write that and then see where what comes out. And then I wrote a book that makes absolutely everybody cry the right time. But I try to keep humour there, and I try to be true to myself. And I try, and I. It's writing a memoir is hard enough because it's hard to remember anything from yesterday, right? It's hard to remember what you have for breakfast.
Yeah.
It's a really strange process.
Yeah.
And there were some things that I was pretty clear had happened, and some things where I wasn't sure of the order. And so it was a hell of a lot of work. But I'm pleased I did it.
I mean, you know, it's beautifully written. It's very moving. And I think, like, also it explains so much about you. And I know you've had bad press over certain instances in your adult life. And were you ever, you know, when those things were going on, did you want to say, look, this might be a reason that there's some anger in me, or that there's, you know, because the book is beautiful. I think it's very. There's moments where you let the anger out, right? But it's very measured, and I think the reader or the listener, in my case, was listening to the audiobook, is angry on your behalf, right? I mean, I think even just not being told that your mother was ill, and your dad not telling your mum she was ill, her not knowing, but what just that putting a child through that makes me. As a dad, makes me so angry.
Yeah. Well, a big prompt, actually, you asked me what prompted me to write the book, and I've got two sons now. My daughter's 12, my sons are 10 and 6. My son, my youngest now, is nearly to the day the age I was when my mum died.
Yeah.
And the idea that if Katie got, you know, God forbid, I'm not a God-fearing person, but you know what I mean, if she should die from leukemia suddenly, and I'm... The idea that we would not have a grave, or somewhere you can go, the idea that you wouldn't talk about her, then I know that Rio Ferdinand, as you may know, lost his wife, his mother of his three kids. And they had a thing called a memory jar, and you could just write any memory of mum down and pop it in the jar. And then if you wanted to, any time you wanted to, you could go to the jar. I thought that was a beautiful idea. I really found that profoundly moving. And I, of course, you would do... I remember when Jay Goody died, you know, I mean, that was so unbearably sad, but she had two small boys and she made a great effort to write things down for them, make little videos for them, try and have, you know, try something. And because my mum was not given the chance to do that because she wasn't told she was terminally ill. She was told she was getting better. Mm-hmm. And then her ashes were buried in an unmarked grave and she was never spoken about again. And that isn't even the worst thing that happened.
No, it's, so, but you know, that it's bad enough.
And it makes me pretty cross. You know?
And to put on you as a 6-year-old, you know, you weren't allowed to tell your sister about it. You know, it's just absolutely, and yeah, this is nowhere near the worst thing in the book. And I'm absolutely furious just about that. So it's, you know, it's amazing to see it. But I think also it sort of, it explains some of the stuff about you that, you know, that's
some of my worst mistakes.
Well, you know, we all make mistakes, and certainly the public eye people make mistakes. Do you think, you know, Robin Ince has this, you know, theory in his book about comedians having, you know, loss in their childhood or having bad. Do you think you would have gone towards comedy regardless, or was comedy something that gave you sort of solace from this?
I really find it a difficult question. Lots of people ask me, and all I can say is my brother and sister are not comedians. No. there was something about comedy that I loved. I just love laughing. I love comedy. I love comedians. I love sitcoms. Yeah. You know, I still do. And that's my favourite thing. A funny person is just my favourite thing. I like it like everybody else. When a new comedian appears or a new show appears, I love it. And I wanted to do it.
Yeah,
and I wanted to do it, but my problem was I needed the audience. I needed the love of the audience. I needed that appreciation. And it was actually Izzard Eddy, funny enough, who he lost his mum when he was six.
Yeah.
And we talked about it because we were really contemporaries. You know, we started pretty much the same week doing stand-up. And he said, the love of the audience replaces the love of your mother that you've lost. It's as simple as that. You don't have to analyse it any... And I thought, nah, it's nonsense. But he was right. He was absolutely right. Because no one will ever give you the unconditional love that a mother will give you. No one will ever speak to you. I can't remember the sound of her voice. I can't remember her face. You know, it's really difficult. But an audience, you can talk and they will laugh. And then the really hard thing is when the show finishes, they all piss off. And then you start drinking and getting into fights.
Yeah.
You know, or Eddie doesn't. Eddie has his own things, but that's what I do. And losing fights, badly.
Well, it's I absolutely recommend the book. It is beautiful, even though it's... It's traumatic to read, so you know it's hard to imagine how it was to go through it. But well done for writing the book, because it's really great to see people, whatever the experience, to talk about stuff as well, because I think people don't talk about any of those of the things.
A lot said about Twitter, and you can get abuse from great rock stars, and you can get abuse from ordinary people. You can read some awful things. People say terrible things to you. But when I wrote my book, I went back onto Twitter and lots and lots and lots of people have been in touch, and lots of people have said they'd had similar experiences, mm-hmm. and lots of people have said, your books helped me or spoke to me, and that means a huge amount to me. That makes it worth it.
And it's so much of I think just the years we grew up and the way the world was and the way men were and the way... You know, people didn't discuss their feelings, and you know, it's so 70s and 80s. It is, you know, there was something at the heart of the society
you
that was
not, don't cry, the, ever. Yeah, you never ever cry.
So, even with nice families, which I think I was, you know, I don't have any apart from my dad being my headmaster, which may be my trauma. I don't have any proper trauma like that, but it was a really fucked up time. And so, you know, if we can, for the next generation of, I think of men as well, especially, because it's, you know, I think it is that inability to cope with feelings that sends men into terrible, horrible, insane places.
Oh, yeah. Well, and we could, you know, perhaps we shouldn't, because it's a comedy podcast and people can't have a good time. But, I mean, there are a lot of suicides, aren't there? So, but, you know, it is important. You're right.
But thank you for writing it, and it is well worth your time if you want to pick that up, if you haven't heard it already. Let's talk about Jonathan Creek. Hooray! Yeah. That was fun. I've watched all of them quite recently, maybe just before lockdown, because it was all on Netflix. I don't know if it still is, but I watched the whole thing start to finish. It's like Death in Paradise, but like really good. Like, it's the same. It is. It's weirdly similar in that it's, you know, why don't do a convoluted, difficult crime, because Jonathan Creek will solve it. Just stab someone and run away, because he won't be bothered about that. But it's, I mean, the writing in it is obviously a big part of it. It's David Renwick. Mm. It's interesting to watch it, because it must have been so hard for him to keep up the quality of it and the intricacy of the. I don't know if he thought he would do as many series as he did, but it's a phenomenally written thing, first of all.
He finds it incredibly hard.
Yeah, it must be.
And he's a real... He said to me once, I'm not a glass half-empty person. I don't have a glass. He's always on set, and he always looks at us all as if to say, I can't believe these people aren't going to... fuck this up completely. But he's a really a brilliantly clever writer, extraordinarily clever, and the show's full of references and allusions to various things in comedy, but also in magic and in similar types of shows. A big influence, of course, is Sherlock Holmes and the locked room mystery, and making sure that there's a kind of lineage that you're part of. So it's this is what makes it last, really, because it's the ideas are kind of timeless, and so people are still coming across it, and they don't really realise quite how funny it is. I mean, I just learned the lines. I learned the lines to the absolute full stop. David is extremely particular, and you learn every single syllable, and you don't change a word. And in the later years, he started to direct them, and he would storyboard them. He's quite a good cartoonist. And in one of the storyboard frames, there's there am I in the duffel coat, arms folded, looking out the window. When we came to the shot, I had my hands in my pockets, and he came over and said, "Do you suppose you might fold your arms?" And he pointed to the drawing. I said, "I can fold my arms, David, if you like." So he's very, very particular, and on top of all of it, and on top of the edit, and full of tricks. So he would write. I remember in one episode he wrote an elephant's funeral. And there was an elephant that was in a show, in a kind of comedy show, magic show, and it died in the theatre. And he wrote the elephant's funeral. And Verity Lambert, was our producer, said, "We're never going to get six elephants, nose to tail, walking through London." Okay. All right, I'll lose the elephant's funeral then. I'm fine. Threw a big huff, knowing that that was never going to get made, but in so doing, able to salvage another scene that was also a bit pricey. Well, you've ruined the elephant thing, so let me have this. You know? In the end, we didn't even have one elephant. We just had the sound of an elephant trumpeting in the wing, and then it cut to a shot of me and the other actor, whose name's I can't remember now, but... And he's going, he's having a little drink, and he's going, "It's what she would have wanted. She loved the theatre." Very, very funny. You know?
Yeah. But it was, I think, you know, obviously, like, it was you all the way through. I can't imagine him going, "Right, we're going to, you know, you don't want to do it, we'll carry on the series." I think the relationship, especially with you and Caroline Quentin, I think was phenomenal, right? There was something just, the chemistry there was great.
Yeah, well, again, it's all written.
Yeah,
it's all written there, you know. He wrote the part of Maddie for Caroline. He went to Caroline. Caroline at the time was married to Paul Merton, and he went to their house for dinner, and she's quite a good cook, Caroline, but it was pretty chaotic, and things were getting burned, and she's talking all the time. And he wrote a scene doing that in one of the episodes, and he always wanted Caroline to do it, and he wanted Nicholas Lyndhurst to do Jonathan Creek. And he didn't want to do Jonathan Creek because... they'd just finished Fools and Horses, and David Jason was doing Frost. And he thought, "I better not do a detective thing. I'll do Goodnight, Sweetheart."
Yeah.
So...
Imagine if that had been the other way around.
So that was, you know, that was one hurdle out of the way. Then Hugh Laurie was said yes. Hugh Laurie was going to do it. And then he got cold feet and changed his mind didn't want to do it, so... Then they started auditioning people, and they auditioned at 38 white men, obviously. It was the 90s. The Jonathan Creek pilot was 5 white men. The first 10 years of Jonathan Creek was about 600 white men. I mean, it really was.
Yeah.
Let's not pretend we didn't benefit. I was the 38th.
Right.
And Susie Belbin, who was the producer of the first series, had produced all of One Foot in the Grave, and she saw me doing a reading for a sitcom and said, "Have you met David Renwick? Are you coming to the BBC Christmas party?" I said, "I've been to the BBC once in my life. I don't know going to the Christmas party." And I turned, it's a black tie thing, so I had to hire a black tie suit and bow tie from a shop in Stamford Hill, so I looked like I was going to a Jewish wedding, you know, and put on my own duffel coat, and then ambled in, didn't know anyone. And David tells a story that as soon as he saw me looking like that, he thought, "That's the bloke over there." Doesn't fit in, looks a bit silly. And so then the first few scripts were already written, and they'd been written sometime before, but after that he started to write with my voice in his head. and it became easier and easier to learn, and the scenes between Maddie and Jonathan were so well written, you know. And it was that we'd won the BAFTA in the first series for best drama, and we'd been made by the comedy department, and the drama department were livid. And I thought, oh, this is what it's like. You know, you do a show, you win a BAFTA. And it's the only BAFTA I've ever won.
It still stands up, though, doesn't it? I mean, that's, and a lot of things from the 90s don't stand up, and there's bits that make you a bit more uncomfortable. But I think Jonathan Creek is you know, it was always pretty on the button, and it's, you know, it's not, there's nothing...
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think there was one storyline he had where there was a character as a police officer, and Maddie and Creek couldn't agree on whether this person was a man or a woman. Oh, yeah. And there's some quite funny stuff, but in the current climate, I don't think they'd show that episode.
Okay.
People quite, you know.
Yeah.
But it was bloody funny. At the time.
I think I remember, like, from the old radio days, you'd written a sitcom about your life, that was sort of you as the main character, and was that for TV or radio? They were arguing about you not being famous enough to play yourself in. Have I remembered that right?
Oh no, there was a couple of things. Well, I wasn't famous enough to be Jonathan Creek. That was Alan Yentl was controller of BBC One, and he wasn't happy about it.
Right.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
He wanted Lyndhurst.
Right.
But no, that's not quite what happened. I had an idea for a sitcom where I was going to basically be a comedian and have a couple of friends who got up to silly antics. And we had it all worked out, and then Seinfeld started.
Oh, right.
The exact show, done way better. But what happened was the producer who had commissioned the script wanted it to be different, and I couldn't get on with her. And I said to the production company, we just can't agree on anything, and I really don't think I'm going to be able to work like this. I feel like I need somebody else to work, a script editor or something else. And they said, if you don't work with this person, then you're in breach of contract. I said, what's that mean? Does that mean I'll be fired? And yes, that is exactly what it meant. I was fired off my own show. Yeah. So then the script started getting sent round to various comedians who were contemporaries of mine. It was called Just Shut Up by Alan Davis and a guy called Paul Waite, who was the co-writer on it. And the main character suddenly wasn't Alan, he was called Adam. And people kept ringing me saying, I've just sent a script that you've written. What's happened? I said, I've been fired. And that was a bit upsetting. And I thought they were going to make a mess of it. And they did. It was terrible. And then I did a show on the radio, on Radio 4, in which I played a kind of pompous actor who was a bit above himself, and very, not a stretch. And really loved doing that. And in the radio theatre, not dissimilar to this room, actually, and Kevin Eldon was in it every week doing different voices, and Alan Francis and Ronnie Ancona, and I loved doing that. And then they said, will you do a pilot for television? And all the same shit started happening.
Right.
The exact same bollocks, you know. The producer wants to change the script, the writer doesn't agree with me, and I said, why does this happen? What is wrong with people? It was so much fun. A month ago, it was really fun.
Yeah.
And I asked John Lloyd to direct it, and he came in and said, this script is terrible. And I thought, oh, shit. And so I quit. And right. And actually, it wasn't until White's 10 years later that I found myself in a sitcom. I always wanted to be in a sitcom.
Yeah.
And I kept blowing all my opportunities.
But it's weird. It's so, especially when you say that there's 38 people who could have been Jonathan Creek, and they choose the least well-known person possibly. It could have been, you know, the idea that Nicholas Lyndhurst could have been Jonathan Creek, you know. I'm imagining it and I'm loving it, but but it would have been a very different show. And yet TV still does this thing where it's like, you know, it's got to be a well-known person rather than the right person for the role, even to the extent of a show written by someone about themselves and trying to cast someone else.
The funny thing about that, when I got fired off my own sitcom, which was being made by Carlton Television, I was really unknown, and they didn't think it was any loss losing me, and they thought they'd get another actor, and my co-writer wasn't particularly loyal to me. Then, after that, I got cast as Jonathan Creek, and then Carlton came back to me and said, we've got another sitcom we'd like you to do. And they tried to crowbar me into something else that another actor had already been cast in.
Right.
And I felt very uncomfortable about that situation, and the producer and the director of that show told them to bugger off. So, well done them,
yeah.
I'd say.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Right, well, look, we've taken up nearly enough of your time. I think we haven't talked about loads of things, but that was going to be inevitable. I saw on Twitter that your dog pooed outside an oligarch's mansion the other day. Well done for that.
Yeah, it's true. It's a wonderful moment. I'm very proud.
And, you know, I thought you suggested that they should put Ukrainian refugees up in that mansion, which seems like a good idea.
There are several mansions in Highgate,
yeah,
at the top of Hampstead Heath, which are enormous. There's one called Wittenhurst. There's only Buckingham Palace is larger. I mean,
right.
I shit you not. And in the deli, I'd walk my daughter to school, and in the deli where I get a cup of coffee in the morning, the woman who works in there told me that when they were doing it up, money laundering,
yeah,
she said that they were putting gold leaf on the swimming pool ceiling. I mean, they spent $100 million on this place. And then round the corner there's Beechwood House, which is owned by an oligarch, and beyond that is Athlone House. And Athlone House is a huge mansion. And you can see the tops of these buildings right across Hampstead Heath. They're incredible mansions built in the 19th century. And Athlone House used to be an RAF convalescent hospital. Right. But also that was a little bit of a front, because it was a place where they trained spies. And they trained hundreds of spies. They trained hundreds of RAF operatives in espionage tactics in that building.
Right.
So the idea now that it's owned by an oligarch feels a bit peculiar to me. And I would walk in my dog past these places, and they really are enormous. So I put a tweet up saying, why don't we just seize these and repurpose them? And anyway, a week later, they were seized. But they haven't been repurposed. But I think they should be. And I'm sure I can't find anyone who disagrees that we could perhaps do a bit more for refugees from Ukraine than we are doing here.
Yeah. Well, it seems like a pretty good solution, I have to say. But that's not always going to ride with the government we have as we record this podcast. But I was saying in January, when shows that were going out in February, was, will Boris Johnson still be Prime Minister? And saying, yes, he will. And I think he will be when this goes out. That's my...
Yeah, I think you're right.
That's my prediction. So is there anything coming up? More QI... Another series of QI?
We have recorded another series. It will go out in the autumn.
Anything else exciting that you're allowed to talk about?
No.
I do a show
for Comedy Central called Guessable. We're hoping to do more of those. I did, you know, quite fun things, but no, nothing major. Oh, I did an episode of McDonald and Dodds.
Okay.
Which, if you like Death in Paradise,
yeah,
you're going to love.
I'll check it out.
I play an eccentric professor. That's coming soon.
Brilliant. Well, look, it's fantastic to get you on after all this time, Alan. I can't believe you haven't been on before. Will you give a massive round of applause to the amazing Alan Davies?
Thank you very much for coming. Thank you, everyone at Leicester Square Theatre, for having us. You have been listening to Rahulastapa with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Alan Davies. Thank you to Scant Regard. They do the music. You know that by now. I'm indebted to my producer, Ben Walker. I'm also indebted to Chris Evans. Not that one, or that one. Come on, get real. And everyone at the Leicester Square Theatre, thank you for having us during this fabulous run. You have all been marvellous. And thank you to the whole crew who do the filming and recording. Even George, the incompetent sound man. Even he deserves a thank you. I would also like, he's just waved merrily at me, very happily. I would also like to thank the following Kickstarter backers: Barry Sowell, or Soli, Dan Powell, Kevin Franklin, John Sparks, Paul Levy, Jonathan Prythurch, come on, Thomas Smith, Chris Notley, Scott Pezza, Joanna Seymour, Simon Howley, Louise Troest, Trevor Hackett, George Alex, Crispin Lowe, Martin McDonald, Raymond Halpany, John Lynch, Hugh Lind Edwards, Dink Taylor, Fraser Levy, John Walker, Jim Parkin, David Smith, Andrew Sandel, Ian Daly, Joel Gethin Lewis, Benjamin Lowry, Mark David, Emma Nincompoop Feeks, also Douglas Sinclair, Morgan Nash, and Jervin Burnside, who got their information in late, but not too late to get their names in the credits. This is a Sky Potato Fuzz and GoFasterStripe.com production. Head to richardherring.com/gigs to find out about my Edinburgh run and the forthcoming Leicester Square Theatre run and any other extra gigs we're doing, like the Deershed Festival. There's some of the Phoenix. They might have happened by now. I don't know when this is going out. Now go away. Thank you, everyone. See you again. Bye. Thanks very much for listening to the podcast. Go to GoFasterStripe.com for fantastic downloads and books, and to join the Go Faster Stripe Club and get loads of stuff from really interesting comedians. Help little Chris Evans knock that one out. That would be lovely. All right, RichardHerring.com for all my gigs. Hope to see you at a gig. Come and say hi after if you've enjoyed these podcasts. Don't come if you haven't enjoyed them and say you haven't enjoyed them. It'll make me feel sad.